Well, good morning, everybody. Welcome to class this morning. Let's all say hello to Mike Cope. Can we say hi?
Hey, Mike. Hey, Mike.
All right, there you go, Mike. Made your morning, didn't it? Okay, let me go ahead and just do two quick advertisements, super quick, so that we can get those out of the way and then get into things. First is, if you guys like this event and are looking for something else over the course of the summer to be a part of, let me encourage you to take a look at the North American Christian Convention. That's going to be in Southern California for the first time in many, many years, well over a decade. That's the kind of largest annual gathering of the independent Christian churches. But this year, it's going to be in Anaheim in July. So it's the week after. It's like, I think, somewhere around the 10th of July. And it'll go on all week long at the Anaheim Convention Center. Usually about 10,000 Christians there. You'll see some of the usual suspects from here that will be participating in the program. And so let me just encourage you to go ahead and avail yourself of that. I also would just say, if you're at a church that is really, really gimping along or struggling, and to the point that you're having to make some decisions about your overall future as to whether you're going to, you know, maybe transition out, go out of existence, or merge with somebody, or do things like that, that's something that I have a lot of experience with, and our church has a lot of machinery you know, to help you go through that process if that's something that you need to explore or whatever. So I'm offering that to you. You can reach me via email at tim@newvintagesd.org, and I would love to be able to share that with you. So here's what we're going to do today. I'm going to tell you a few stories, and I'm going to basically try to convince you that whatever it is that you're seeing now, that God is up to a lot more than whatever it is that you're seeing. This class is going to eventually become a book, and it's based on, the reason I decided to pick this topic instead of my usual church leadership stuff is because one of the biggest problems that church leaders face, particularly, and Christians face, is that they don't really see or embrace even all that God is up to. And I've had a lot of people come up to me and say things that lead me to believe that that is the case. One example, when my wife and I announced that we were going to come back to Southern California for ministry, a lady that I have a lot of respect for and is still a good friend to this day objected and said to us in the process, you don't want to raise your children in California. And she said that, of course, obviously forgetting that I was born and raised in California myself. And so it was mildly offensive that was the case. But what she was saying is essentially, California is a dangerous place. Stay here in Texas where there is no sin. Okay, is what she was saying. And that if, in fact, there was, if Texas was, let's say, less sinful, and it's better to raise your kids in a less sinful context, then what you want to do is shelter them, right? So we don't view our kids as maybe eventual missionaries in training. We view them as property to be protected. That might be a little harsh, but not property is not what I mean. But, you know, there's stuff that we got to protect. And there's a fear that of the other and of things that are out there. Another example would be I remember walking out of a restaurant, not a bar, a restaurant in the Gaslamp District of San Diego, where I live, and running into some Christians who objected to my presence in the area. Now, the funny part was they were there too. That's how they saw me. But they thought it was wrong for me to be there because they know that the Gaslamp District of San Diego, it's just a downtown area. It's not a big, profound, you know, anything different than what you'd see in Los Angeles or anything else. But they thought that I shouldn't be seen down there because it might give people the wrong idea. I'm there with my wife. We're just walking out of a restaurant after we had dinner. Another one. You know, Facebook, the blessing that it is and all these different things. You go in and you check in at different places. My wife and I attended an event in Las Vegas earlier. It happened to be a pastor's conference. It was not we weren't even there just for pleasure. We were there attending a pastor's conference. And I received again the criticism of others for just having been in the city. After all, it's known as Sin City, et cetera, right? So those people are out there. Now, you can look at them and say they're extreme, all right? So let's take them and put them in the extreme camp. On the other side, you've got people who I would say lack when it comes to seeing the harvest. They don't think that you ought to remove yourself completely, but they still haven't developed a taste for it yet. And what I mean by that is if they had their choice of who, for instance, they went to church with, there's a part of them that in their conscience knows, hey, I should be open to this, and therefore I will force myself to be open to this. So when the guy walks in, that is covered head to toe in tattoos and looks like he and smells like smoke and you know, and things. So at our place, we have a Christian biker club that shows up, and about once a month, there's about 40 or 50 bikers that show up. The parking lot is full of Harleys, and they show up, and they're awesome. We love them. They're called the Black Sheep, and they roll in there, and they are a rough-looking crew when they show up. They often don't wear sleeves. They got tattoos all over. They smell, some of them, like smoke. And so there are people that, you know, are there. They just don't know how to handle it, right? And so they go, hey, welcome to the church. You know, the greeters are trying to figure out what to do. Now they kind of know who they are. But back in the early days, it was tricky to help them learn how to do that. But they tough it out. They do it. But they wouldn't necessarily seek it, right? So over here, you have people that are afraid of what you might call the harvest. And I'm going to define the harvest as any one or thing that God is doing for the purposes of his kingdom, that he's bringing into his storehouse, okay? You got the people that just, you know, have a problem with it. Then you have the people that will stomach it and tolerate it. Then you have another group, which is, I only like people who are not Christians. And they're people that are almost allergic to their brothers and sisters in Christ. They see that the church is the problem. The church is the one that's responsible for this and that and the other. So they almost completely prefer non-Christians. And so part of the problem there is that they can't, they don't like working in the harvest field with their own, with their fellow workers. They think that we got a union problem there. They just don't, they don't want to partner in it with others. So these are the people, for instance, a lot of millennials, a lot of missionals. They'll go to a bar, drink a beer with a guy, and call that missional. There's not a sense of the actual harvest piece of it. They don't really have any desire to be a part of the church in any formal sense, or in very few formal senses. They think it's about one thing, and that is, I'm going to go out there and I'm going to reach people because the church has jacked everything up, et cetera, et cetera. What I'm going to aim for is something kind of over in this other camp, which is that one that recognizes that the church itself and the people that are outside of the church are all part of God's harvest. And that what God is often doing in the world is a lot bigger than we always seem. And I'm doing it as a way to help encourage you to, number one, if you're in a depressing setting, and I don't know anybody that is in a setting that doesn't get depressing at least sometime, then that you will be imbued with some fresh hope to maybe take a look at it a little bit differently, or maybe be a little bit more patient about what God might be doing, and to open your eyes to what God might be getting ready to do. If you're in a great setting and you can see it, then it's an attaboy, attagirl, let's keep going. But for a lot of us, too, I'm going to tell you just some very personal stories, some of them tomorrow particularly. I want to let you know in advance will be kind of heartbreaking, but they're wonderful stories of God doing his thing. John 4. Those of you who have Bibles, go ahead and grab it. That's the famous chapter where the story of the Samaritan woman at the well is told. Now, we go through the chapter. Everybody knows the Samaritans were viewed in a poor way, et cetera, et cetera. Jesus goes to the well. He's just getting a drink of water. And he goes there and has this encounter with the Samaritan woman at the well. When he does, you know, there's this great scene where she ends up, you know, comes he, the man that told me everything I ever did. And she goes out and she starts proclaiming to the villagers, right? So usually that's where the sermon stops, right? That's kind of like where we cut the story off and we say, all right, that's what happened then. I want us to focus on what happens after that. In the aftermath, as usual, when God has done something great, the disciples show up and are displeased. It happens a lot. They don't know why he's talking to her. They don't know why all of these different things are going on, what's happening. And so they come up and they're kind of nervous and they're kind of like, okay, Jesus, let's go. And so Jesus then says to them, don't you have a saying? It's still 4 months until the harvest. I tell you, open your eyes. Look at the fields. They are ripe for harvest. Now, I want you to put yourself in their shoes. Are these the kind of people? Or would you look at that and go, you know, yeah, Jesus, you're exactly right, right? I mean, had you not been there, right? The disciples are not there. They come in after the fact. They don't even see what's just occurred. They just see him talking to a woman who's gone into the village and is preaching. He says, take a look, open your eyes, see the harvest. They have to look around and go, what harvest? All I see here are a bunch of, we would use the language maybe in our culture, like infidels or something. These people are not the same as us. We don't need to have anything to do with these people. But what ends up happening in that story is after he says it, the people of the village then say, hey, why don't you stay with us for a while? Now I can imagine the apostles again saying, no, thank you. Let's go on. Let's keep going. But Jesus stays with them a while. Anybody know what happens next? The whole village basically is converted to Christianity. Okay. So he goes, he didn't just do that. They invite him in. He stays with them. And then the whole village becomes Christian, essentially. Okay? So we often say, well, she went and proclaimed it to the whole village, and that's how everybody became Christian. It's not really the case. That certainly obviously planted a seed, but what happens is that they then, it's the people of the town, take the initiative, and they say, Jesus, come stay with us. Jesus says, okay, he stays. And then from there, that turns into something that completes kind of the process of harvesting there. Okay, so a few things to point out, right? Number one, Jesus is just getting a drink of water. A lot of times these things don't happen when it's just through a big sophisticated program of outreach. It happens when you least expect it, which is why you have to kind of see the world in harvest terms. See things through the lens of opportunity rather than obstacle. You see them rather than feeling like you've got to have a formal machinery for ministry. You approach everything with this particular lens, looking at it as though, I don't care who these people are. I just got out of the breakfast for Let's Start Talking. Gordon Dabbs in Preston Crest. Their Friendspeak ministry is just exploding. They have a long waiting list. They've baptized dozens of people. And it reminded me that when I was in Dallas and we started a Friendspeak program, which is basically helps people practice their English using the Gospel of Luke. Okay, so it's a way to reach international people. So we were right across the street from low-income Spanish-speaking apartments when I was in Dallas. I mean, just a huge complex, divided kind of very patchy. Half was predominantly African-American, half of it was heavily Hispanic. So we go, hey, we want to reach those people somehow across the street, so let's set up this program. So we put it out there, and we advertise it, and you know who showed up? It was Asians. And you could drive around and you wouldn't find a single Asian American person for miles. And the question is, well, what in the world happened? And what, first of all, why aren't people across the street coming, right? That's one way to think, right? You go through the harvest field and you think to yourself, hey, these are grapes. Why don't we have jalapenos, right? And that's one of the reasons that happens is because you have... We think that it's like our harvest field and we're unaware of the things that God is doing. So we end up with Asians that are taking buses from far away. That the Preston Chris Friendspeak program, they're UTD students in Denton, Texas, going all the way to North Dallas. It's a long drive. So they're driving there or whatever, and they've got dozens and dozens and dozens of Chinese students when they're trying to reach Hispanics in the area. Right? So they're looking at it, and it can be confusing at first, just like, for instance, the disciples are here, and they're trying to reach a particular group of people. Unfortunately, who they end up with are Samaritans. Sometimes, like in the churches that I've been a part of, what we're trying to do is, rather than kind of taking a look and saying, God, we really will be responsive to anybody you send us. Anybody you send us, we will receive them. Any place you want us to go, we will go. Those are platitudes, those are those kinds of things, but they're not embraced fully by the church. So they end up with a bunch of Samaritans, and they don't see what it is that Jesus sees. He sees the world in people and harvest. He looks around at that moment and he says, look, open your eyes, the harvest is plentiful. I mean, imagine, take yourself to a place right now in your mind where you think to yourself, boy, that is a God-forsaken place, people group of people, either a group of people you don't like, a group of people you think are non-receptive permanently. You know, let me help you. What if ironically, the church throws out this huge thing, hey, we want to reach whatever, and then what ended up happening was the church had thousands of homosexuals come to Christ. You know, and the church might be thinking, no, that's not, we're trying to reach millennials, right? We're trying to reach young families, not them, right? And so what ends up happening, I've seen that happen over and over and over again. that whatever church I'm a part of is trying to reach this particular group, and that's not what happens. You reach this group. And without explanation, it just happens that way. Jesus is passing through Samaria. He has no intention of staying there. But that's where God had prepared the harvest, right? So as he goes through, that is what happens. And maybe one way to put it is, if you look at harvest as wheat, okay, we have too many leaders in churches who are committed to a gluten-free diet, if you know what I mean. They don't like it. They're almost allergic to certain groups of people. And by the way, sometimes that includes millennials, or for people my age and under, sometimes it includes people like empty nesters, elderly people, people that frustrate you. Last night I was talking to a guy who is in a church planning network, and they are killing it in retirement homes. They're planting churches in retirement homes all over the United States. And it's not the kind of ministry that you would choose, because after all, right, what does it do? It's not the kind of people we want, right? We want hipsters. We want young people. We want young families. We want people who can kind of come through and do it. But the question is, whose harvest is it? Is it God's or is it ours? And if it's his, then that means I'm going to sit here and I'm going to keep my eyes open, and I'm going to be ready for anything that God wants to send me. When I was here as a student at Pepperdine, there was a woman that remains a very close friend of mine to this day. And I was in the campus ministry office, which back then used to be over there by the entrance to the cafeteria. And at the time, she didn't know I was in there. I had unfortunately kind of gone off the deep end for about a year spiritually when I was here. And when I did that, I'd done it in a relatively public way, in the sense that I was kind of a well-known Christian kid. So when I did that, it was obvious to a lot of people. Well, the church, I'd kind of rebounded from that and everything, and the church had made the decision to bring me on as an intern. And so this created some controversy among some of the folks here. I'm not even sure they were wrong. I just think it was fine. But I happened to be sitting in a side office. This lady did not know I was there, and she came in to see the preacher on the campus at the time. His name was Dan Anders. And again, this lady is a very close friend of mine today. Okay, so I'm not speaking ill of her or anything. She remembers this. And can I ask you a favor? Would you pull the door shut real quick? I have like one of those audio ADD things, and I can't. If I hear noise, I can't focus. You're awesome. Thank you. So I'm sitting there, and in this side office, she comes in and tells the minister of the church she's upset that they're bringing me on as an intern. And she basically says some very hurtful things in the course of that conversation about me and about what she thinks I'm good for at that moment in time. All right. She doesn't know I'm sitting right in the other office. And when it's done, she goes out of the office, and the preacher, Dan, comes in and basically says, don't worry about her. She doesn't yet know what God is getting ready to do with you. So don't worry about that. It's almost like Ruby Bridges last night saying, forgive her. She doesn't know what she's doing. So I end up coming on as an intern, from intern to staff, from staff to, you know, a lifetime in ministry. But back then, if somebody said, hey, look at that kid, you don't see harvest there, you see weeds. And that's why I think it's important. Jesus tells a parable. It's one of the most confusing and infuriating parables he tells. Very seldom preach, which is the parable of the wheat and the weeds. I'd encourage you to look it up later, but in the parable, basically, you have a person who's going around, and some people call it there's one that's like it called the wheat and the tares, but it's not exactly the same. There are different versions of this one. But in this particular version that I'm speaking of, he's saying there's somebody that's going along and he's sowing the wheat among the weeds. And so somebody's going along trying to weed the garden and pulling weeds. And so basically God says, look, don't pull weeds, because you're going to pull up the wheat with the weeds. You don't know the difference between wheat and weeds. So all you need to do is just leave my harvest alone. Okay? And when the time is right, I will go about and I will pull out I will separate who's a weed from a weed. But that is not your job. And so I've tried to stay very loose with that, remembering that at one point I would have been viewed as a weed and was viewed as a weed who eventually became part of the harvest, right? In a lot of places, those kinds of stories could be told. And what it does is it makes us, it brings about what I would, just a very deep scarcity mentality, because when we look at people, we kind of judge weed or weed. And if we think that they're going to be non-responsive, we just go on to the next place. Okay, we assume that they're one way or another. I told this story a few years ago, and it really is one of the best examples of it I've experienced personally in my ministry. It was a Wednesday night. It was a Wednesday night service. I was preaching in Dallas, Texas at the time. And it was this huge church building we had. And it was about 30 minutes before Wednesday night church started. Nobody was there. And there's one dude. He's sitting out in the middle of the room, Hispanic guy. And he looks like he's praying or something. And I'm kind of going through just getting set up and everything. I'm tired. I'm irritable. I knew I had a bad elders meeting coming after it was over. And I was just not in a greeting mood at the time. But there was something said to me, hey, go say hi to the guy. Just go say hi to the guy. So I said, okay, I'm going to do it. I'm going to be obedient here. And I forced myself to go over there. I did not want to go. I was tired. I was not feeling my normal extroverted self. But I go over and I say, hi, I'm Tim. And he goes, hi, my name's Sixto. And I said, okay, hey, wait. And I recognized his name from the area. And he was he had been on staff at another church in the area, and had had some troubles in his marriage, and had and at least at that point in time, his marriage was, he was separated from his wife, and had been fired from his job in ministry because of that. So he had come to our church on that Wednesday night to heal up, and I remembered, I didn't know the circumstances, I just knew that he's supposed to be somewhere else tonight, and he's here, so. Anyways, I just said, hey man, you know, look, I don't know what you're doing, but if you need to talk to somebody, let's get a cup of coffee next week. So he and I have coffee, he explains what's going on. It becomes obvious to me in the course of that conversation that this guy is sharp, he's committed to God, he is got a church planter's harvesting kind of mindset about everything, and that he's good at it, too. He's good at it. So what he does is we sit there, and all of a sudden, the next thing you know, I can walk you through all the different stages. But it goes from the handshake, where I could have just not said hi to the guy at all, in which case I don't know how the story ends. Today, that guy is still, we ended up starting a Spanish-speaking church there under the campus, which went to 200 in 1 week. From that, we started a Spanish-speaking church planting network with him as the head that is planting, I don't know how many churches, it's probably in the 30s or 40s by now. He's still there at the same church, and is just a serial church planting trainer, and has just, God's done a mighty thing in his life. He's sending his own son now out as a church planter, who he raised there at the church, right? And I sit there and I go to myself, I go, no, okay, so what if I had done one of two things? Either said, no, I'm too tired, I'm not going to do it. Or I had said, oh, no, he's got marital problems. We can't, God's done with him then, or, we obviously that disqualifies him permanently from ministry or things like that, right? A lot of the people that God uses in mighty ways have resumes with blemishes on them. David, Moses, I mean, I go on and on and on. Peter, denial of Jesus. You can just go down, and there are resume blemishes on a lot of these people. But if you look at people and you see weed and not wheat, you miss out on a ton of what God is trying to do. It is just hard to be an effective harvester if you are a gluten-free leader, if you have an allergy for what harvest looks like. Okay, and the definition of harvest, right, is that when you're going through and you're harvesting something, right, means it hadn't been picked before. The very nature of it is that this person is outside of the kingdom, and now they're in. God has brought them in. So when I'm going out and I'm reaching them, that means that that I should expect that they're outside, that they're not already sitting in church next to me. It's the definition of it. The church that we're in, we started 5 years ago, And I'm very thankful for what's happened there over those 5 years. We run about 400 in attendance, and our greatest success, our greatest outreach of people, you're listen to this one, wine drinkers. New Vintage, right? It's in the church name. My wife and I love wine. We go wine tasting. We meet people at the wineries. We bring them to church and lead them to Christ. We have our small group that we started now has, last Sunday night, we had 68 people in the small group. That's a small church, not a small group, okay? And almost everybody in that group has some connection to either the school that my kids attend, but the way that the connection was made was through a winery, not through the school. Right? Now, normally, it would be, you're a Christian, you shouldn't be at a winery. See what I'm saying? So, well, that's fine as long as you don't want harvest. Harvest, though, is going to be in a place where things that are far from God are. Right? So that's what I mean about being gluten-free, right? Is I can't be around things that need to be harvested because I have an allergy to it, to them, to it. And so part of, if you want to reach people, I think, in a substantial way, what we've got to do is increase our immune system, spiritually, so to speak, so that we can actually go and be among people who are far from God without getting sick ourselves. Okay, I don't want to suggest for a second go out and just freewheel and put yourself in actual spiritual jeopardy. But for most of us, I mean, let's be honest. I'm not that afraid that the average Christian is going to go into a bar, for instance, get plastered and become a raging alcoholic. The odds of that are much smaller than them staying outside the bar and everybody in there going to hell while they stand outside judging the people in the bar. Now, the odds of that are much better. So if you look at the way that those things happen, and I want to emphasize, I'm saying do this stuff thoughtfully and responsibly, but we cannot, we're never going to be able, if we have like a spiritual celiac disease, we'll never be able to be effective harvesters. We just won't. And so part of it is learning to love lost people. I mean, some of the earliest people we met in those wineries are now leading those groups. They came to Christ. They've been trained. They've been discipled. They're leading small groups. And eventually, who knows, maybe they'll go on and plant a church someday. But that's kind of what we're trying to do, at New Vintage. It doesn't always look the way that we would choose, which is why I try to help our people understand we are harvest workers. We are not grocery salesmen. All right? Big difference. A harvest worker means I'm going through the field. It's somebody else's field, and I'm gathering what they've planted and stuff, and it's theirs. A grocery salesman takes what they planted, has already been harvested or whatever, and sells it. All right? So if I'm, in the Christian sphere, what that means is outreach means it's God's field, it's God's harvest. I'm going out and gathering what he's already prepared. If I'm a grocery salesman, what that means is I'm taking what I already know and I'm trying to sell it to people wherever I go. There's a huge difference in seeing it that way. This gathering right here, I'm going to turn the light off so you can see what this is. Let's see. This is a very frustrating lighting system. No, that's not it either. Let's try that one. There we go. All right, so quick story. 2 weeks ago, Saturday night, I go to my wife and I say, our girls are done playing another day of softball. I've got three daughters, all three play. I was at the softball fields from 8 o'clock in the morning till 5 o'clock in the afternoon. I was on my feet all day. Total beatdown for a father. I mean, I loved it. I love watching my kids. You're in the sun. You're dehydrated. You got irritable coaches running around. It's just one of those things. And those of you who have kids that are playing sports, you'll know someday what that means. But I'm also on the board of the league, and it's a job that I'm the scheduling director, and it means that I'm open to a lot of criticism from people because they want fields for this, or they don't think their game should be here, da-da-da-da-da. And I thought, hey, I'm done. I told my wife, I don't see a point to this. I'm done. It makes no sense to put this kind of time and energy in and to come home frustrated every day, every Saturday, and beyond. So she goes, great. And we were both celebrating together, right? Because it's like more time, or and we were all excited. So at that moment, I'm done. I'm washing my hands of it. I'm walking away. Literally, before I can say anything, before I can type the email and send it out, there's a high school girl that in the league. By the way, keep in mind that most of the people that go to this league, there are a lot of Christian, like parents with kids in the league. But the board itself is, I think, there was one Christian out of 44 board members that's an open Christian. All right, I mean openly Christian, and actually practicing in some way. She gets sick. This girl does. She's a pop behind shortstop. She's running out, collides with the left fielder. She gets a concussion, goes into the hospital. She has a weird virus in her body that nobody knew she had. It just takes over, attacks her brain, attacks her lungs, attacks her heart. She has a heart attack at 15 years old. In the hospital, ICU, coma. Boom, just like that. So the league, and everybody around the league knows this girl. And so grief strikes. They don't know how to handle that. Right, because when you're going through grief, and you're not a person of faith, this gets weird and tricky. You feel like you ought to do something, you just don't know what to do. A Christian would probably respond with prayer. They'd get together with other Christians for support. But when you don't have that, right, people don't know what to do. So what ends up happening is they come to me. I go, hey, aren't you you're a pastor, right? I go, yeah. And they go, well, not really religious, but I kind of feel like we ought to say something. I go, to who? And they're like, well, I think we ought to get together and maybe have a and at first it was a moment of silence and thoughts about whoever. And what they wanted to do was to have a night where anybody that wanted to could show up and offer some thoughts and moment of silence and things like that. And I told them they wanted to be sensitive to everybody's religious preferences. This is California, right? So. And I go, well, I said, let me just suggest that people who are going to show up for something like this are expecting something like prayer to happen. They're not going to be offended by it. And in fact, a lot of them would probably be very comforted by it. And I said that in part because I didn't want to be pushed into this corner of having to make a decision between, do I want to lead this from a civic standpoint and do it for the sake of the community, but also get wrapped up in some sort of new agey, vague moment of silence thing that sends a message to people that I don't really believe very much in what I preach. So what ends up happening, this thing just begins to mushroom. And by, this is Monday night. That's 2 days after I was getting ready to quit. What you can't see there's about 400 right there. What you can't see is there's about 500 people behind me when I'm taking this picture. All right, so I'm behind home plate. That's facing out to center field. And behind the backstop, there's another 500 people there. A lot of those people, and there are people from all over the community, there's people, all this stuff. So I get up there, and I lead all these people, all these board members, all these whatever, in a prayer. The other thing you can't see is it's raining. It's cold and it's raining out there. All right? And I get up there, so 48 hours after I'm getting ready to quit, all of a sudden now, I'm leading the entire league in prayer. On a Monday night, they're coming out in the rain to do this. How in the world that happened, right? You look at that and you go, I was getting ready to quit. And the reason I did was why? I looked out and I saw a barren land. No harvest here. I didn't see the harvest. God saw the harvest and maybe thought, okay, he's getting ready to quit, so maybe I better speed this up, or I don't know what he did. But I mean, I just sat there and so I got home Monday night, and Emily, my wife, and my daughters were already asleep, but I just went into Em and I said, honey, I don't even know how to explain what just happened tonight. I said, it's almost like overnight I became the pastor of that entire league because it was such a poignant moment because she was about to die. The mother, they FaceTime her in on a cell phone to just see what's going on. The mom breaks down in tears. She's a very, very gruff woman with whom I've had some spicy encounters in the past. She's bawling on the phone. She's thanking everybody for, she's not a practicing Christian. She goes on, she thanks God for everybody that's there. She thanks me for saying a prayer and for everything. She thanks everybody that's there, and she says, I know God's going to heal her. I just know it. I mean, she's not a woman of faith. We talked about it before. She grew up Methodist, kind of a stern background, didn't care for it anymore. So here she is. Guess what's happened? Well, God did heal her, right? So now you have the whole league watching all of this play out. All within a matter of just a couple of weeks, it goes from a contentious, angry, barren land to, after this, closing ceremonies come. She's still in the hospital, but doing better. They asked me to get up and do it again at closing ceremony. So now I get all the parents and all the every player and all their family is there, which this is just coaches, friends, high school people. And I'm going, how in the world did that happen? I have no idea. And that's the point. Right? I have no idea. So when I look and I see a barren land, it's like the disciples going through Samaria and going, let's get out of here. This is crazy. And just like that, God shows you that how little it is that we know and that he has gone way, way, way before us and is doing something great. Yesterday, I was in this room and I N.T. Wright was talking to just a small group of people. I like to say that I let N.T. Wright borrow this room for yesterday because I'm a nice guy. But he came in, but he was in here and he reminded me of a story in 2 Kings 6 that is amazing to describe this kind of what I'm trying to say this morning. Okay, 2 Kings 6, you have Elisha there, and it's one of these deals where God is using him to thwart the king of Syria is after them. And he's using Elisha to basically tell the king of Israel everything that's going on the other side. And so Israel's whooping him. And the king finds out that it's Elisha that's doing it. So he sends armies and people to take Elisha out. Elisha's servant wakes up in the morning. He walks out of the tent. He looks around. And there's an encampment all around. He's got guns pointed at him. They didn't have guns, I don't think. But, you know, guns are blazing. They're ready to take everybody out. And he gets out of the tent. And he's like, whoa. What we got here, he goes back in and he tells Elisha, hey, you know, we got a problem out there. The whole nation is around us. They're trying to take us out because of what we're helping the king of Israel do. And Elisha goes, don't worry. The ones that are with us, we got a lot more armies than he has. And the servant's going, huh? It's me and you, right? So he gets out there, and so Elisha then prays that God will open the eyes of his servant. And so he prays to God, and he says, God, open his eyes so that he can see what I see. And all of a sudden, his eyes are open. He looks around, and he sees chariots of fire and horses all over the mountains. And so then Elisha says, God, blind all of them. So God does. Elisha was a bad dude, man. He really was. He was, as prophets go, he was a tough dude. And you know, he's the one that had the bear come out and kill the guy that made fun of his bald head. So he's a serious dude. He gets out there and encourages. And I guess what I'm wondering is if churches and people that are in ministry, mothers, fathers, whatever, when you feel discouraged, when you feel alone, if that's not a better prayer to say, open our eyes so that we can see what you're doing around us. Because my experience in ministry after doing this almost 20 years and trying to help reach people is that it works a little bit like Field of Dreams in the sense that, you know, only the people who believe in the field can actually see the guys playing. That it's like that. When you believe that God's actually doing something, that's when all of a sudden you can see what he's doing. But if you really look at it, all you see is barren land and you can't see the harvest that's there and what God's already done. Elijah, look, Lord, I've been very zealous for you. I alone am left. He goes, no, you're not. I got a whole bunch of other people out there you don't even know about. And I bet if you go through your own personal journey and you start thinking about all the times that you didn't see God coming, but he came strong when he did. And he showed up and he did something great. So there's going to be a church of 20 people that's out there that's in decline, hasn't seen any growth for a while, and God may turn it around, or it might be that what they see as an empty building that's useless and depressing becomes something that he uses it ends up being dissolved, but it's used to plant 100 churches, right? The barren land is what it felt like. Harvest is what it was. A person that you know, that's a friend of yours, that is a, you know, an addict or a, you know, all those kinds of things. You may look at them now and go, that's a weed, not weed. All right. you know, let me just encourage you not to necessarily think that way about them. I'm pretty much out of time today, so I'm gonna pause there. Tomorrow, what we're gonna do is tell stories, like the one I told you there, and I'm gonna tell you probably a handful of them, and then give you some specific church, and two or three of them will be church stories, two or three of them will be personal, and show you how the harvest thing works, and hopefully how God can restore our vision for these things. Thanks for being here. Let me lead us in prayer real quick, and we'll turn it back over to Mr. Dabbs, who's coming in after me. Lord, thank you for your many blessings. Thank you for being Lord of the harvest. And I pray, Father, that you open our eyes, that we can see all the mighty things that you're doing around us. Father, open our eyes to see what you see, and use us, Father, according to your purposes. Help us to see ourselves as harvest workers, not grocery salesmen. Help us not to be afraid of harvest, but to embrace it. We love you, Lord. It's in Jesus' name we pray. Amen. Amen. Thank you, guys. Have a great day.